us. Much appreciated. On a Tuesday, let's get Tommy in here from the couch at his house. Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
The sun is just barely over the trees here in lovely Greenwood.
Lovely?
It's a gorgeous day to be alive.
Ah, that's lovely. Thank you for that, Tom. Diving in there. Wow, it is chilly, chilly, chilly in the lake today. We will zoom in at 9:20 on Jacob's Mustache.
Okay.
All right, Tom, let's get started. Amazon selects New York City and Northern Virginia for its new headquarters. We'll play some sound for you, and I'll tell you how I do something similar to this at least twice a week. Here we go.
They say that Amazon will receive in Long Island City performance-based direct incentives of $1.5 billion. And so it gives you a sense for the scale. That's just one portion of the incentives. In Virginia, it's going to be approximately, roughly $573 million in addition to other incentives. So, you know, relatively large scale. We're talking hundreds of millions and more than $1 billion.
So they split it, and this is what's done in the auction business all the time. You ready, Tom?
Okay, let's
hear. Say you have a trip.
How are you and Amazon similar?
Here, let's say you have a trip to Bali. It's a 16,000 square foot. It's got five people that work there. You're right next to a scuba thing. Okay, that's nice. Your phone's ringing. First of all, you got a landline in that house? How depressing is that?
Yes, I do.
That is really depressing. Is that your VCR turning on? All right. Hey, is it a call center you're working at now?
Yeah, I'm picking up a little money on the side.
You can't even get off the couch to answer it.
See, I think it went away now.
Okay, yeah, that's what happens.
Hey, you know, you're the one to talk. You have your cell phone on. It goes off.
No. I turn it off. I don't just let it keep ringing in the background, annoying everybody. Okay, hang on. So we're going to sell an item. You ready? It's a trip to Bali, and it's 7 days, 6 nights, and it sleeps 10 people, and it's 16,000 square feet, and they've got a maid, and they've got a cook, and they got everything else. Ready? Start the bidding. At 5, now 15, now 10, now 25, now 30, 35, now 40, now 50,000. It's at $50,000, 50,000. You're 55, you get a bid 60, 65. And then you know what you do? Then you go, you know what? You know what? You know what? You're both going, bang, sold it twice for $65,000. So what you do is you create the impression that there's only one of these things, and then you come up with this moan in the auction business as the secret second. And it's the weird part is both people feel like they got screwed because the auctioneer knows that there's two of these, but they create the impression, and the person never knows. There's one auction I do that they have secret seconds in almost every single item. But you have to keep telling the audience, you never know, you never know, and they never know. But what it does is it drives both of them up because they assume the supply is one, demand is two, so the price goes way up. So here's an exact same thing that Amazon did. Said, listen, hey, we're going to set up a headquarters. 50,000 jobs are coming in. The multiplier effect is going to be 50,000 times 7. Don't you want us there? They all bid. They all drive the bid. And then they go, oh, guess what? You're both getting us. Brilliant.
Okay.
Brilliant move.
No, it is a brilliant move if there's not too much blowback, and it doesn't sound like either Arlington, Virginia, or New York City, or let alone Nashville, are complaining right now.
No.
But your auction comparison is bogus because it would be like suddenly these guys are bidding on Bali and says, you both won, but each of you can only take one guest, not five guests like we promised.
Yeah, you do.
Because basically they were promising 50,000 and now you only get 25,000. So it's only half as good. They get the incentive bonuses which were placed when they thought they were going to get 50,000.
Yeah.
And then they're only getting half of that deal. So I think, much like your customers, I think that there is a kind of a scam going on here and they are getting screwed a little bit, both cities.
Well,
even though they're happily being screwed, I think, for if you ask the mayors of both of those towns.
I've also read that the great thing that they've done is it stops a lot of the blowback that would come with 50,000 new people. So now you've basically separated some of that anger and resentment off to 25 and 25,000 on these. Now, what I'm saying, Tom, is that if the Amazon said, hey, listen, it's going to be 50,000, it's 50,000 people going to come in. That's what people were bidding on. I read a fascinating article that these cities, of the 238 cities that bid on this thing, 20 of them ended up, or many of them ended up giving all sorts of really cool data to Amazon that Amazon now can use. For instance, they showed them, hey, in 5 years from now, we're going to take these 50,000 acres that are off to the side and we're going to put a community in there and we're going to put roads in there. Amazon now has that. Oh, Beth, guess what? We're going to put a bridge that's going to cross this river 20 years from now. We've got that in place. So all of that information went to Amazon. And Amazon's involved in cloud. They're involved in infrastructure. They're involved in drones. They now have data that they're able to use to build profits on. I mean, I think this all around, what a fascinating story this is.
Absolutely. No, nobody's arguing that Bezos isn't brilliant. I guess the question,
sounds like you're getting another call, Tom. You get another call.
That is not me.
Is that you? That sounds like it's coming from
very
maybe you
funny.
Find that right between the couch cushions. Is that one
in
of those
fact,
new, is that one of those new wireless ones you got? Go ahead. I'm sorry. Let him answer.
I bet you were the one that placed the
Tom
initial
Cagney's
call
house, man, help
set up
you.
This whole bit.
No, Tom can't come to the phone right now. He's doing a live radio show. Okay, I'll have him call you back. All right, thanks. Bye-bye. I handled that one for you. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, man, you and Bezos, you're cut out of the same cloth. You cash in on everything.
Go ahead, Tom. I'm sorry.
And so, listen, I want to take advantage of your expertise in that area. Can you explain what the difference? We've been talking Crystal City. In fact, I heard Ursula just mention Crystal City. And yet in the formal announcement from Amazon, it says National Landing. What's the difference between National Landing in Arlington and Crystal City?
Well, let's go to Jacob for that answer.
Yeah, well, from the article I read, it indicates that even people familiar with the area aren't familiar with this term. This is a branding term that Pentagon City and
Arlington?
Crystal City came up with so that they could file jointly with Amazon in order to kind of pool their resources.
Yeah, I've never heard of that, Tom. I know it's near Arlington.
Okay,
yeah, kooky. That is kooky. All right, let's see. Got some other sound here from Todd Bishop from GeekWire. Let's see what the deal means to Nashville. Don't really care about that. What does it mean to Seattle? We're a local radio show. We care about local news.
Clearly, they will now start focusing their growth in these other three cities. And I think that leases and new buildings that we've been seeing in Seattle over the past 3 years, I think a lot of that will start going elsewhere. So we will not see the growth at the same pace that we've seen here in Seattle. For me, one of the most fascinating things to watch is going to be the housing market. We've already seen a dip in home prices. What's going to happen here in Seattle as these Amazon employees and executives are given the option to go to one of these now other three places? That's the other quick thing here. You know, if it was just one place, it's a binary decision, Seattle or New York, for example.
Right.
But now that these employees have the option, I think it increases the chances you're going to see more people leave.
Oh, that's great. So what we'll do is we'll constrict the economy and prices will come down and then houses will be more affordable. Isn't that what the city council and people were pushing for? Because Amazon was responsible for the prices going up of houses, which is total crap. And Amazon, will be responsible. Tom, it's a supply demand. You can't scapegoat Amazon because of supply and demand. Seattle has some of the most restrictive building zoning regulations in the country. And if the NIMBYs, they're so strong, like for instance, in your neighborhood, they're not going to let anybody build a duplex or anything else like that. So you create 100,000 new jobs. You build 32,000 new houses. It's a supply demand equation that's in effect. Amazon all of a sudden is responsible for it. So when Amazon moves people out, now is Amazon responsible for, the fact that the housing market is collapsing? We're going to blame them for that as well?
Oh, come on, John. First off, the housing market is not collapsing. It's just cooling off just a hair. And I think this might actually be a nice compromise that right now, if we... The idea is Amazon does not want to be the only business in town. That's one of the things that they were looking at. You go to New York and you go to D.C., they are not going to be the only ones impacting the economy. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, they realized that if they want to increase 50,000 more employees in Seattle, that we already have 45,000 here. That would just we would basically become Amazon City, and they wanted to spread the wealth, so to speak, and the talent pool elsewhere. So I think it's actually probably good that we've already benefited from the Amazon economic boom well enough. And now if some of those some of that pressure dissipates to New York and Washington, D.C., that's not all bad for Seattle. And besides, they still now they could change their plans.
Uh-huh.
But right now, we have 45,000 employees here in Seattle. They're only going to have 25,000 in New York and D.C. I'm not sure how many people from Seattle are going to be moving to Washington, D.C. and New York, because they're already the talent pool in Washington, D.C. and New York is already through the roof as well. So
right.
I think this actually might break in Seattle's favor, unless, and Todd Bishop might know this, unless you think that at some point Jeff Bezos is just going to, you know, pull up stock and leave Seattle,
mm-hmm.
which there seems to be no indication of them doing. So I think it's probably a win-win-win all the way around.
Well, here's Bishop talking about whether the current residents of these locations are happy with the news. No, that's New York and Arlington. I'll say this, that if the thing that you have to also consider, if you're a high-tech kind of, coding ninja, like these guys that they bring in, there's the difference between living in Seattle and living in New York City. It's night and day. So everything the advantages of the environment of Seattle, that you're skiing and boats and water and people and talk radio, specifically this show, you lose all of that. But people that want to live in a really dense urban area like Queens, Seattle is a completely different option for these folks. And the same thing with Washington, D.C. You know, Washington is a whole different feeling. So each one of these marketplaces is different for somebody that's got a marketable trade. And hopefully Seattle continues to retain the people that, you know, appreciate what we have here for our environment.
That's right. I think that all three cities, and maybe in Nashville as well. Now, do we have time to talk about this? I think there's this great article in The Atlantic about what Amazon is doing. It's typical of what all major corporations are doing, and how maybe we should reconsider whether we should allow them doing that.
Yeah, I read that as well. I'm going to bring up one more thing, and then can we continue that one?
Because
we need a little bit more time. I just really cool little article.
Yeah, okay.
So in 2016, yes. The American, I forget the name of this think tank, AEI, they said what the best thing that Amazon could do and Jeff Bezos could do is go to St. Louis, Detroit, or somewhere in West Virginia. They said if they had done that, they would have broken the cycle of poverty that has existed for three or four generations. And the only way, and then you would revitalize the community. You'd have young people coming in that would demand the schools to be better. They would buy up the houses. They would fix up the neighborhoods. And you would actually come in there and vivisect that cycle of the one generation to the next generation. And they took a study, and you and I talked about this about a year ago, that if you're born in a crappy part of town or a crappy part of the state, the chances of you coming up out of that section, that like you're trapped, like it's like quicksand, you can't make it out of there to something else. And then you just continue that cycle of poverty. In 2017, the American Enterprise Institute, that's what it stands for, said, move to St. Louis if you really want to have a dramatic effect on this country.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And the problem is, and you would be the first to defend him, Jeff Bezos's job is not to make America great again. Jeff Bezos's job is to turn a profit.
Yes.
I agree. I think it would be so wonderful if Amazon was such a powerful corporation that the way they could kind of justify their monopoly on our life practically is if they were rejuvenating these really hard hit areas like West Virginia or St. Louis and all. Mm-hmm. The problem is the reason they say they chose New York and Washington, D.C. is there is a real battle for the talent pool.
Right.
And you think it's hard to convince people to move to gorgeous Seattle because mm-hmm. we're so far out. Can you imagine trying to recruit if Google, which is doubling its presence in New York City, mm-hmm. is going after the same, basically talent pool as you are, and you say, oh, come to lovely St. Louis. We're going to be part of a St. Louis renaissance. Or you could say, hey, stay in, sort of explore the greatness of New York City. It wouldn't work. And unfortunately, there's not enough incentive for Jeff Bezos to make America better again if it hurts his bottom line motivation.
I know. It's just a pie in the sky idea that they came up with. I mean, they saw
Yes, but it would...
it would change things.
It absolutely
would transform. Then you could lives. I mean, generation upon generation would be affected by this. But you could also look to see what happened in Atlantic City. So Atlantic City in 1974 votes to allow casinos to come in. The poverty rate in Atlantic City was a really just a horrible place to live. They built all these casinos. They hire all these workers. But nobody who lived in Atlantic City went the eight blocks towards the boardwalk to apply for the jobs. They continued to live the life that they lived. And everybody that wanted to work in the casinos had to come in from outside the city because the people that were so dependent upon the government and had become enslaved by the welfare program, they had no incentive, nor did they care, nor had they ever seen anyone in their house ever wake up to an alarm and go get a job. So that part of the problem.
I think that's an unnecessary slur on the great citizens of Atlantic City. But that is interesting if that's the case, that none of them wanted to work in a casino.
Well, they didn't. Everybody had to keep coming in from outside the area. And then the study that was done said, hey, 20 years later, all of this new building and all this other stuff that went on in Atlantic City, but it's still, they didn't move the people. They were eight blocks from the beach. All right, let's do this. Let's move that one story forward. By the way, we did zoom in on Jacob's mustache at 9:20. Thank you very much for that. I know that's uncomfortable for some of the people that are watching us, but it's now become part of the show. Let's see. We'll get to the fact that at one point, the Tide Pods, Tom, you never ate a Tide Pod, did you?
No. In fact, it turns out almost nobody did. It was more of a joke. It was sort of a social media meme. There was, unfortunately, a child, like a three-year-old, who ate it and died, and that got in the news. But it became kind of this bit that people were doing, and it turns out they were just pretending to do it as a joke.
Okay.
But still,
Tide's got a
Tide Pod.
But Tide has a new problem now because they're afraid that people are going to start serving a Tide at cocktail parties. We'll explain that. Plus, also, this guy changed the way we watch football forever. And we'll talk about a guy that does some wrestling. He is a villain. He's known as someone that supports Hillary Clinton, doesn't like Donald Trump, and is a big believer of Obamacare. And he gets booed all across. Is he just in this area or all around the country?
In Kentucky.
No, really? He's just in Kentucky? We'll get to that. Plus, also, we're going to celebrate the anniversary of the worst decision ever made by a bunch of local government officials in Oregon. Right back. Laura's Home Loans. Last name is Keel. When you hear that name, you're like, oh, yeah, I know Keel, Laura Keel. That's right. Give her a call, 833-ASK-LAURA. That's 833-ASK-LAURA, Laura Keel. Laura's Home Loans, people to call when you need a mortgage. Apparently, though, the housing market is collapsing, Tom, whether you know that or not. So if you don't need that.
Keep talking it up, John. Talking it up.
It's always it's down $80,000 offers for houses. So it just makes it more affordable for everybody. It's good. All right, let's see. I didn't know who this guy was. You read the article that was in the Ringer. Mike, how do you say his last name?
Pereira.
Has changed how people. What are you laughing at? That I don't know how to say his last name or don't know who he is?
No, that you don't know who he is.
I don't know
that
who he
undercuts
is.
The entire premise of this 30-page article that we're about to discuss.
I know what he does. I mean, let's bring people up to speed. 20 years ago, they invented the yellow line that you now are able to point to say, well, that's where the first down is. And that changed the game. Because you're like, well, how far? I don't know. They're not showing the sticks. Okay, so there we are. Now we've got the yellow line. That was 20 years ago. And then when we had instant replay brought into play, the people that were in the booth, the one guy doing play-by-play, the other guy doing color, there was always gaps as to somebody has to fill it while we're going to go ahead and look at this replay. Both of them were just sort of throwing in their two cents on it. And then this guy, Mike Pereira, say his last name?
Yeah.
Okay. He has changed the way we watch football. So go ahead and explain that, Tom.
Okay, so right now, because of instant replay, I didn't realize this, for about 7 years, Replay was banned by the NFL. They were not going to do replay. They thought it got in the way of the game, and it came back, I think, in like 1999. But there was a time where they had it and then they didn't have it. And when they brought it back, broadcasting team in 2010 decided, you know what? We need to have an analysis from somebody who knows the rules of football really well to explain to us while we're waiting, because it feels interminable. Mm-hmm. 3 or 4 minutes to 7 or 8 minutes when they're trying to decide what the call is. There's so much riding on so many calls. They're game crews. They hire a guy. He used to be an official himself on the field. Then he became the supervisor of all officials. And when he retired, I forget now which network it was, CBS, I think maybe, called him out of retirement and said, listen, would you like to be our on-air commentator? Mm-hmm. We'll go to you to explain what the rule is and what your judgment is about what's happening on the field before we hear the official notice. And they say that really has transformed football because of the instant replay. We now spend as much time as fans, as much time arguing about the rules and the incorporation of those rules into the game as we do talking about, you know, the fantasy football players that we have on our team.
Here is one of his calls. So this is 2010. He has weighed in on several times. So here we go. This is how he fills the time.
Hey, I'll tell you, the rule is very specific, and you only have to go back to think about Calvin Johnson. In the process of going to the ground, you must maintain control of the ball when you hit the ground. Now, that's what happened here. The ball hit the ground and popped out immediately. That's an incomplete pass by rule, and it's been consistently officiated like that all the way back to 2010.
There you go. So then the other two guys can go, oh, okay, great, thank you. Then you go back to the live action.
What's great about this article, though, is they talk about how stressful, you know, the beads of sweat that come on these guys, because Dean Blandino is now another guy who works with him. They're the two most famous of these commentators, and how nervous they are, because Dean Blandino used to be the official NFL replay guy in the booth in New York City that would then, you know, override or influence the call in the field. Well, he said that was so much easier than actually being a TV commentator about this, because you just apply the rule. And he said it's relatively black and white. But when you're on TV, you are now giving good information to your listeners. And when the officials on the field end up going against what you say,
right,
you look like a fool.
Right.
He says, even if you're right, the people on the field are the ones that have the power, and it stresses them out. So he says it's unbelievably stressful to have these kinds of jobs. Otherwise, it feels like, oh, that's great. You sit around watching football all day and occasionally comment on a play or two.
Yeah, I guess as you're sort of laying it out there, you probably want to leave yourself a little wiggle room. Like, well, from where I see it, this and this, but again, the officials may have a different, rather than saying, oh, that guy was definitely out of bounds, or that is not a pass.
Yeah.
That's not a reception. One other quick little sports story is the fact that there's a wrestler. This is more about politics than about the sport of wrestling, but a wrestling villain praises Hillary Clinton and invokes Obamacare and meets progressive liberals who and body slamming his way through Trump country. Is this guy originally from Kentucky?
No, he's not, and that's what makes him so ornery. He's from Virginia.
Okay.
And anybody from Virginia in Kentucky world, you know, is already an outcast and a loser This guy is a wrestler. He just does it on, I think he's a real estate salesman, but he takes 2 or 3 days of the week off to go do this little wrestling circuit, and so he's really big in Kentucky because he calls himself the progressive liberal.
Right.
He wears little blue wave tights, and it's a hilarious villain that he's created that people love. He says, listen, the whole thing about wrestling is you have to create heroes and you have to create villains. And he says, basically, the more I can irritate and emotionally rile up the audience, the more they're getting their money's worth.
Yeah.
He says, they're paying to see me get my ass kicked, is how he puts it. And that's exactly what happens.
Real estate agent Van Harnsberger has moonlighted as wrestling villain the progressive liberal Daniel Richards since late 2015.
Get up, Kyle Fox News maggot!
Mostly in small towns in western Kentucky and east Tennessee. The progressive liberal persona is the product of the very real friendship between Dan and his mentor, Bo James, and their real antagonism over politics and Appalachian culture.
It's a struggle between my beliefs, his belief. Dan is seen as an outsider coming into these mountains trying to tell us how to live. He's no character. He's no gimmick. It's him. It's not just the politics.
It's the hypocrisy of the right that I can't stand.
So your politics informs your style of performance?
I think the people's narrow-minded view gives me a platform to troll them.
Okay. He has been told by his fellow wrestlers, you might not make it out of the building alive. It's, you know, it's one thing to be the villain for whatever reason. You can create some sort of backstory, right? But this guy is striking these people because they look at it like Obama came in and killed the coal industry and put everybody out of work. And Obama is a horrible person that's caused people to get onto opioids and divorces and beating their kids and kicking their dog. So they look at politics of the left has destroyed, not that Kentucky was any great shakes for a long time, but politics on the left has hurt them. So then they see this guy as part of the reason that they don't have a job and that their kid is pregnant at the age of 15.
Yeah, this this is a fascinating article about this because it's funny in that he's basically baiting them with all of the things that he knows drives them crazy. He just shouts out renewable energy, and you know this is coal country, so they all boo him.
Right.
Better health care. He calls them stupid. He talks about their idiot fathers. I mean, he really is outrageous, and so that's kind of funny because that's what you want. He says he's just like the coal, like they said the Russians during the Cold War, the big bad guys were the Russians. And yet at the same time they talk about why it's why he touches such a nerve, because it's really depressing.
Yes.
Kentucky, especially coal country. And they you know that something like 30% of the population, you know, are drug addicted, they're mm-hmm. on opioids, they've got high unemployment. It's really kind of sad. So it's a real kind of a roller coaster ride. But basically his fellow wrestlers protect him because he knows if he's not the only reason they're successful, he's one of the reasons they're successful. And mm-hmm. so they have to give they act like his bodyguards as he gets in his car and drives away so he wouldn't get killed by the audience.
There's an interesting thing that they do when you go into the locker room with all the other wrestlers that are in there. When they shake your hand and you shake their hand, it's a really, really soft handshake, almost like they're not gripping at all. And what it basically means is, hey, I'm in on this to take care of you. You're in on this to take care of me. We're not going to go out and hurt one another. It's sort of this secret sort of cultural thing that goes on. The handshake is really soft. It's not an attempt to show I'm that much stronger than you. And it shows that we're all in this to put on a good show. Isn't that kind of crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, you go to shake a wrestler's hand. Yeah, go ahead.
He tries and he does this one time match. At one point, he just yells out at the top of his lungs, Hillary! And then everybody in the crowd shouts back, moron! Gotta love wrestling.
We're back. Write to us online, Trading Academy, text line 98973, 98973. Do love to hear from you. Come on in, everybody. Plus, you can also get to us at MyNorthWest.com. All right, an opportunity to enjoy dumb things the government has done. Here we go. That's right, Tommy. Take it down a little bit, Andrew. You're blowing my ears out. It was on this day. Was it yesterday?
Yesterday.
It was on yesterday. On November 12th, 1970, that the silly folks in Oregon decided they would try to get rid of a beached whale. Do you remember this story, Tom?
I do. I vaguely do, because it was so hilarious and hellacious at the same time.
It had been so long since a whale had washed up in Lane County, nobody could remember how to get rid of one. In selecting its battle plan, the Highway Division decided the carcass couldn't be buried because it might soon be uncovered. It couldn't be cut up and then buried because nobody wanted to cut it up. And it couldn't be burned. So dynamite it was, some 20 cases or a half ton of it. The hope was that the long-dead Pacific gray whale would be almost disintegrated by the blast, and that any small pieces still around after the explosion would be taken care of by seagulls and other scavengers. As everything was being made ready, we asked George Thornton, the highway engineer in charge of the project, for his final observation.
Well, I'm confident that it'll work. The only thing is, we're not sure just exactly how much explosives it'll take to disintegrate this thing so the scavengers, seagulls, and crabs and whatnot can clean it up.
Is there any chance it might be more than a one-day job?
If there's any large chunks left, and we may have to do some other cleanup, possibly set another charge.
Okay. All right. How did it go, Tom?
About 75 bystanders, most of them residents who had first found the whale to be an object of curiosity before they tired of its smell, were moved back a quarter of a mile away. The sand dunes there were covered with spectators and land lubber newsmen, shortly to become land blubber newsmen.
I'm sorry.
For the blast blasted blubber beyond all believable bounds.
Oh, wow, wow. This is the best part. Have you ever seen it? It's in black and white, but you can tell how incredibly gross it is. So he looks at everybody, he's like, whoa, look at that. And then...
Oh, no. All right, Fred, you can take your hands out of your ears. Here comes
the... Our camera stopped rolling immediately after the blast. The humor of the entire situation suddenly gave way to a run for survival as huge chunks of whale blubber fell everywhere. Pieces of meat passed high over our heads while others were falling at our feet. The dunes were rapidly evacuated as spectators escaped both the falling debris and the overwhelming smell. A parked car over a quarter of a mile from the blast site was the target of one large chunk, the passenger compartment literally smashed. Fortunately, no human was hit as badly as the car. However, everyone on the scene was covered with small particles of dead whale. As for the success of the effort, well, the seagulls who were supposed to clean things up were nowhere in sight, either scared away by the explosion or kept away by the smell. That didn't really matter. The remaining chunks were of such a size that no respectable seagull would attempt to tackle anyway. It might be concluded that should a whale ever wash ashore in Lane County again, those in charge would not only remember what to do, they'll certainly remember what not to do.
There we go. Gum move by local governments.
Actually, I don't know. You know, that doesn't seem like such a bad idea. We are now playing it 40, 50, 60 years later, that very report.
Well, I think what they do is a lot of times they looked up what do they do with whale carcasses. They take it and they drag it over to a compost pile. They say the smell is pretty bad, but once the thing kind of gets past that, the stuff that's left is really good for whatever you're trying to compost with. But, yeah, if you watch the video, it's really funny to watch huge chunks of it flying up in the air and then coming down on people as everybody ends up running for their lives.
Well, you know what's – and you heard it in that last ad, so Jacob sent me a link, so I did watch it. What kind of ridiculous TV photographer stops the film after the explosion?
I know. Isn't that kooky?
I mean, the story turns out to be what happened immediately after the explosion. They don't have that. They just have the explosion itself. Apparently now what they do is they bury the whale. They dig a deep enough hole that's the proper disposal practice now. Great story, John.